Yes.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So we'd like to call to order our monthly District of Columbia Board of Pharmacy meeting. Today is August the 3rd, 2017. We will begin with our open session. So to start things off, we will introduce ourselves to you. This is members of the board as well as staff who are present. Followed by that, we will ask you as members of the public to kindly introduce yourselves as well. Please make sure to sign the sign-in that is back there somewhere that will go around. And if you are affiliated with any organization, please state that in your introduction as well. So I'll start things off. I'm Daphne Bernard. I'm a board member.
Good morning. James Appleby, board member.
Good morning. Eddie Curry, board member.
Good morning. Benjamin Miles, board member.
Staff present.
Hi, Karen Scipio Skinner. I'm sitting in for Dr. Shauna White.
Corinne Barron, Health Licensing Specialist. Good morning.
Lawrence Holland, yes.
Good morning, Carla Williams, Board Counselor.
Thank you. And so if we can start on this end, if you could just introduce yourself, please. State your name, and then, like I said, if you're affiliated with any organization.
Hi, my name is Trey Boo. I'm a fourth-year pharmacy candidate from Howard University College of Pharmacy, and I'm on my Safeway admin rotation.
I'm Raji Khani. I'm a fourth-year doctor of pharmacy candidate from Howard University. I'm working currently at Walmart, so Walmart's here.
Don Zawater, D.C. Public.
Good morning. I'm Lisa Legan, pharmacist and director of government affairs for Express Scripts.
Hi, Jennifer Thomas with Del Marva Foundation, the QAO for D.C.
I'm a free pharmacist in D.C.
And I stand for Kaiser Permanente.
Good morning. Alicia Bailey, second year pharmacy student at Howard University, and I'm a Safeway intern.
Hi, good morning. My name is Tamisa Williams. I'm also a second-year student at Howard University, and I'm also doing an internship with Safeway.
Good morning. My name is Zachary Mills. I'm a P2 at Howard University. I'm on my IP rotation at Safeway Pharmacy as well.
Welcome. All right, thank you guys for being with us today. So we'll start off with approval of our open session meeting minutes from June 1st, 2017, as well as July 6th, 2017. So board members, when you've had an opportunity to review those minutes, we'll entertain a motion to accept them.
Are we doing as one motion or two separate motions?
I think we can actually do them as one motion. That's okay.
Yes.
Same here.
So we have to separate them. All right, so first we'll start with approval of the June 1st, 2017 minutes.
I move that we approve the minutes from the June 1st open session.
Is there a second?
I'm second.
Okay. Any discussion? All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Abstentions? The motion carries.
We're supposed to be going down on consensus.
Yeah. All right, so for the July 6th minutes, is there a motion?
I will move approval of the July 6th open session Board of Pharmacy minutes as presented.
Okay, second?
Second.
Discussion? Is there general consensus in favor of the motion?
Yes.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Abstentions? The motion carries. Next item on the agenda is our executive director's report. And I'm not sure if we have that, Karen, since Shauna's not here.
Pharmacy technician trainee 177, pharmacy technician 786, pharmacist 1,900, vaccination and immunization agent 524, pharmacist intern 648, pharmaceutical retailers 1,164, pharmacy technician trainee programs 8, grand total 5,270.
Thank you. All right, the next item on our agenda is our Assistant General Counsel's report. Carla?
Yes, I just want to give the update that we did get final rulemaking published for the continuing education requirements, adding the LGBTQ training for the renewal for pharmaceutical detailers and for pharmacists. The one for technicians should be published tomorrow. And so that just means for the renewal for 2019, that will be an additional requirement to complete 2 CEs in LGBTQ training.
And so can you clarify, is that now 42 CEs that we have to complete or 40 including the two on LGBTQ?
The board elected to not add to your total, so it's still a grand total of 40 for pharmacists. I think for detailers, Corinne, what's that number?
15.
So your number, total number does not increase, but within that requirement, you need to complete the 2 CEs in LGBTQ cultural competency training.
So for the community, for the audience, so now that's 2 in HIV, 2 in med errors, and now 2 in LGBTQ. So still 40, but out of those 40, DC is specific that there are certain CEs that have to be in those areas. So again, HIV, med errors, which you already know, and now the LGBTQ. For anybody who's wondering, are there CEs out there that specifically focus on LGBTQ issue? Just going online, we were able to find a couple of real good ones. There's one very robust site that does CEs, and so we will put this information in our upcoming newsletter. It will go out in September. It's a September edition, so be on the lookout for that. So not only, remember, this doesn't go into effect until 2019 renewal, but it's always good to at least know where you will be able to go to find the information.
In addition to that, I recommend we put some information on our website because it's new and it's not a lot of training out there, but there is definitely some out there. And I believe someone had told us in a previous meeting that there's a federal website with some information as well. So we should provide those links on our website.
Yes.
I just wanted to ask, is that 2 credits like for LGBTQ, or is it 2 hours, or is it one the same?
2 contact hours.
2 hours, okay. Mm-hmm.
And so is staff charged with putting together then the getting stuff from the website? Is that who does that? Or
yes.
Our communications committee does.
I was about to say, because I'd be happy to work with you to you know, include some additional resources that are online that people can access as well.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
I'm sure Shauna would welcome to help.
Mm-hmm. Could and I don't know if you recall the history, whether this is a requirement that other boards are taking on as well or not, but I wonder if we should be in touch with ACPE to find out if there's a designator code that they're going to put into so that people can know for sure one way or the other. They do that with HIV, they do that with med errors. Since pharmacists are going to be doing this going into the future, if there is going to be a code, if there isn't one, we should ask ACPE to create one. If there is one, we should know what it is. We can see that in our communication. This is how you're sure that it covers the requirement.
Right, exactly.
And to answer your question, the City Council enacted a law that requires every health professional in D.C. to complete this training.
Great. But we don't know if that's just a D.C.
Right. Oh, it's D.C. It's just a D.C.
But I, sometimes, you know, the people in one jurisdiction talk to others and they get a good idea and it gets passed around. So I didn't know whether others were doing it. I suspect D.C. is a leader in this regard, but I wouldn't be surprised if others don't pick up.
Okay. All right. So again, that's with our 2019 renewal, but hey, you know, it's never too soon to at least start identifying where you're going to get your information.
Right. And I think detailers are the second cycle, so that's 2020 for them. Is that correct, Corinne?
Yes.
Detailers? Yeah. 2019 for pharmacists, 2020 for detailers. Okay.
All right. Very good. The next item on our agenda is the subcommittee report. So our legislative and regulatory subcommittee member is not present. Is there any other information? Yes.
Yeah, there's not a lot to give. The collaborative practice agreement regulations, I know we've received some inquiries about that. It's going through the approval process. You've heard me go through the information as to how our regulations get approved. They have to be approved by the Director of the Department of Health, by the Deputy Mayor's Office, by the Mayor's Office, the Attorney General's Office, and then they have to be approved by the Office of Documents and Issuances. So right now, they're with the Attorney General's Office undergoing a legal sufficiency review. As you may recall, we received a large number of comments, and so changes were made based on those comments. Not every comment was accepted. So now we had to go through the approval process all over again. So they're with the Attorney General's Office. From there, they'll go back to the Mayor's Office, and then we'll be able to publish them in the Register for another period. If we make any changes, we will do the whole thing again with all of the reviews again. So they're moving forward as expeditiously as the governmental bureaucracy process will allow. So that's the status quo.
So the good news is we do have a new government relations person who is staying on top of the regulations. So if there's anything that's hanging out there that she needs to know about, just let her know. Because she has the list of all the things. HRLA does a lot of regulations.
I work closely with Amani.
All right, thank you. Next item on our agenda is the Communications Subcommittee Report. So I'll just give you an update. We are currently drafting the content for our September newsletter that's due to NABP, I think it's due next week. Some of the topics that we will include, we've kind of talked about, we wanted to make sure to include the update on the LGBTQ education requirement. Shauna thinks it's a good idea for us to put another article in about drug disposal. And I think there's drug deactivation pouches. There's some drug deactivation pouch information that she thinks will be helpful for our pharmacists to know. I'm going off of memory and I'm looking at Eddie. There was some other. Oh, we want to make sure we put some information in for our wonderful pharmacy technicians. And so we'll have an article in that's targeting pharmacy technicians and what the expected code of conduct is and how they relate to the profession and pharmacy practice in general. And there's probably one other thing that I'm leaving out, but we'll make sure to include some good, useful information in our newsletter that our pharmacists, our pharmacy technicians, and our pharmacy detailers can actually benefit from. Question in the back. Yes.
When you say drug disposal, are you talking about the waste that's generated during normal practice or disposal of products that patients return?
You know, actually, I'm not sure what the article is about. Shauna is going to forward it, but I do know it's something about drug disposal. Yes.
I think I know what it is. Shauna at one point in time put us in contact with somebody from the Behavior Health, where they had the disposable pouches that were free,
right.
That had charcoal in them that pharmacies and providers could all hand out, and they could hold up to something like 45 tablets, 6 ounces of liquid that we could dispense throughout DC. We're one of 10 cities, I think, participating in this, where the disposable pouches are being dispensed throughout the city to anyone that can put these products in there.
Okay, so she has that information.
For the DEA take back program.
Okay, gotcha. So I'm assuming that's what it is,
yeah.
But I guess we'll know once I receive it.
I just want to make a comment. I was in a community pharmacy maybe last week, and I saw a patient turned away. She came to the counter with her medication, and the pharmacist was like, so that's why I'm interested to see what this article will hold and what kind of direction we're going to receive in the community.
Yeah, and I think it's, with the current climate and the conversation about, opioid abuse and so on and so forth, I think the whole drug disposal piece is something that's very important. I remember years ago, for APHA, I think there was a campaign and they were kind of really putting information out about just regular ways that we can properly encourage people to dispose of unused Medicaid. Remember they talked about like crushing it in kitty litter or coffee grounds and things like that. Maybe we need to kind of take a look at some simple information that we can give the public as well. Right now, there is money, as you are aware, that's going into things like drug disposal pouches, and they're allocating a certain number to different cities and so on and so forth. But what if you're in a community and you don't have a pouch? So for consumers to know of a safe way to dispose of medication, I think that might be a good idea. I saw hands. Yes.
Yeah, hi. There is something here from the Department of Health on the disposal, appropriate disposal, so we're passing that out with our brown bag events, and we have it on our website as well, but it comes from the Department of Health. So there is a one-page flyer that basically tells the consumer how to dispose, not to flush, that kind of thing. I think it has, it looks like it has a toilet on it with a, you know, cross, you know, not the, you know, not flush and then you can fix it. There's also a disposal flyer about needles, especially with disposal.
If I could also add that it's my understanding that the pouches, certainly being distributed by free, they're not free. Someone has obviously paid to get them out into the marketplace, so to speak. But I believe they are, you know, through some pharmacies available even for purchase. I think, I suspect that's long-term intent. They hope the public would see this as a way to protect their families and their communities by disposing of things. And the makers of them, you know, claim that you know, they're, of course, superior to alternative mechanisms like kitty litter or coffee grounds. The main reason being that the charcoal actually absorbs the product. And I can't remember the difference between adsorb and absorb. I learned that somewhere along the line in pharmacy school. Whichever it is, and probably one of our students could tell us the difference, the activated charcoal does something more than simply, you know, make the drug unappealing. It actually solves the problem. It makes the drug inert, inactive. But I believe that for most of America, some of these other more reasonable options to make it very unpleasant is a heck of a good start if we can get them to patients to routinely mix it in with coffee grounds or with kitty litter or something like that. But I think the point of the manufacturer is the motivated abuser we'll find a way to negotiate around coffee grounds if that's what it takes, sort of thing. So, but hopefully these pouches will catch on, and maybe there'll be some way to fund them so that they can be widely distributed at no cost to consumers. We'll see what happens.
And I certainly don't want to be out of line, but I always think about our wonderful pharmacy students across the country. I think coal is kind of cheap. At least last time I checked, like when you go buy charcoal, and mm-hmm. kind of, here's my point. What if we can like get like some of our APHA chapters or our SNAFA chapters to kind of come up with some kind of project where they make safe community pouches to give out as an alternative? I don't know. It's just an idea. I probably shouldn't share this, but I will anyway because we have students in the audience. So I live in D.C., and so when taking out my trash last week, or week before last, I looked across at my neighbor, across my neighbor's fence, and there was a prescription drug vial with white pills in it. And this is in the alley, so I'm like, oh my goodness, what's going on? So trash day was the day before. Maybe it fell out somebody's trash. I don't know. No label or anything. So long story short, I went over and I was gonna pick it up and put it in my trash, but I just left it because I don't know what that was. My point is, that could have been somebody's unused medicine, and depending on what it was, it could easily end up in the wrong hands. It could have been like a cat or a doggy or something that somehow got a hold of it, or some kids that are playing. My point is, we really do need to tell people how to safely get rid of unused medicine, because unused medicine in the wrong hands or paws could cause a real big problem. Anyway, I just wanted to share that. All right, so next item on our agenda. So that was from the communications report. So our newsletter is going to have some really good information. So again, you'll be able to access the newsletter on the NABP site. And I also think we send it out by email, like an e-message as well.
Yes.
So you'll be able to get it both ways. So be on the lookout for that. And just special thanks. I can't thank Mr. Eddie Curry enough. This board member is phenomenal with newsletter content topics. He's like a quiet editor over there. He just comes up with some phenomenal ideas, and I think that's helping to make the content of our newsletter even more meaningful for our stakeholders. So really appreciate that. All right. Next item on the agenda is a rundown of our NABP newsletter information. So since we don't have a student here to present for us, I am going to do the honors of just going through and quickly highlighting some things that I think might be important for you to know. So we'll start off with Pennsylvania Attorney General's Office supplying 300,000 drug deactivation pouches to 12 counties, and so this is pertinent to the conversation. You'll see this come up on a couple of topics today. Basically, as you know, in Pennsylvania, there's certain counties. What they did was they looked at information from the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program, which I was happy to know that somebody's utilizing that information in some, you know, in states. So they looked at that information, and plus they looked at information from their drug and alcohol office to see what are counties that are kind of hit most by opioid abuse or whatever. And so they picked the top 12 counties to distribute these 300,000 drug deactivation pouches. The interesting thing, and the thing that made me think about the pharmacy students, is this. These pouches, pretty much, you put your medicine in there and you add a certain amount of water and seal it up. So when I think about, okay, that's really not rocket science. You know, if this is what these pouches really are kind of looking like, I know some of them do have charcoal, but with this pouch, you just put it in, add water, and it'll, like, I guess, destroy the medication. But you know, I think maybe it's interesting to see some of the makeup of some of these deactivation pouches. But at least, you know, in Pennsylvania, they are handing out these pouches and trying to, do a little bit more to get unused medications out of households. The next item, more than 400 medical professionals were charged in a historic healthcare fraud scheme. And so this involved physicians, nurses, pharmacists, other health professionals that were involved in false billing, like $1.3 billion in false billing. And so, you know, for those of the in the audience who might not be familiar, basically what they were kind of doing was they would bill patients for medication that was either never picked up, or in terms of the physicians, they would bill patients for services, like, I don't know, maybe like a CAT scan, and it was never provided. And so this was discovered, and there are 400 people who are in quite a bit of trouble for doing that. The disturbing thing is, as I go back to who these individuals were, these were health professionals. These were individuals whose entire livelihood, usually, maybe for some people it's not, but for most of them, this is their livelihood. And they took a oath. And when things like this start happening with people who are supposed to protect the public, then it's really concerning. So this is something that our Attorney General Jeff Sessions is very much involved in, and I guess it's probably something that you'll hear more about. There was a lot of targeting of our veterans as well. So our vets use TRICARE, you know, that's the insurance for the veterans, and so, you know, in addition to TRICARE, there was Medicare, Medicaid involved as well, but it's extremely disturbing. To know that the TRICARE recipients were involved in that as well. And so be on the lookout for that. But yeah, these are, you know, sometimes bad decisions can have really, really bad consequences as a result. Another issue is we have about 16 senators that are urging the DEA to reduce opioid production quotas. Now, here's something that I didn't know. I was never aware that there is like a opioid production quota that should be met. I guess it kind of makes sense. They want to make sure that we have enough supply to meet the demand. But we have 16 senators that have reached out and said, hey, can we reduce this by more than 25%? I'm not sure where that would go. I checked the names of the senators that signed the letter. None of them were from Maryland or Virginia. These are people from Ohio, Massachusetts, Illinois, and so on and so forth. So we'll see where that goes. Again, it's a letter that's been signed and submitted, and what comes out of it, we'll just have to be on the lookout for that. Compounder Medistat, located in Alabama, has been found to be misbranding medication. And so basically they were doing two things down in Alabama, and again the name of the company is Medistat RX LLC. There were the co-owners, as well as the quality manager and the pharmacist in charge, have all been charged with inappropriate conduct. The products were being manufactured under unsanitary conditions, and then the products did not have instructions for use on them as well. So those are the two main charges that these individuals are being cited for. Another thing, I mean, this isn't news, you know, they did a survey to look across the country to see how many of you have used pain relievers for non-medical use, and we probably talked about this before. So basically, it looks like about 11.3 million people aged 12 and older across the country say that between 2012 and 2014, yes, they use pain relievers for non-medical use. And so when you think about it, more than likely they're using it maybe to get high or something like that for recreational use. And so it's just more information to reveal some of the problems that we're having with inappropriate prescription drug use or pain reliever use. The states that had the highest inappropriate use are Oklahoma, Alabama, Arkansas, Nevada, Arizona, and a few more. The states that had the lowest inappropriate use were Illinois, Maine, Wyoming, Connecticut, and a few more. So just so that you know what things are looking like there. And if you want to read the information on the survey, you can go to the SAMHSA website, and that's S-A-M-H-S-A. They have the full results of that survey available for anybody who's interested. This is important. So the Drug Supply Chain Security Act, which for the past 3 years at the NABP meetings, there's been a lot of conversation about this. This is the DSCSA. So basically, several years ago, someone came up with the idea that we need to better track the manufacturing of, we need to better track and trace medications. So all the way from when they're manufactured to when they actually reach the retail market. We want to put tracers in these packages so we can make sure that, you know, the proper medications are reaching the in the supply chain. Of course, this costs money. And so this was not well received across the board, especially by industry. And so, you know, DSCSA has been out there for a while, but really getting it fully embraced across the board has been somewhat of a challenge. And so the FDA is holding a series of public sessions right up in Silver Spring, Maryland. There's a public meeting on August the 23rd, on December 5th and 6th, and on February the 28th, 2018. So for any individual who's really interested in the whole compound drug supply chain and the impact this might have to you know, manufacturing, then by all means, please sign up to attend one of those public meetings that will be held up at the White Oak campus in Silver Spring. Unfortunately, for the August the 23rd meeting, the registration deadline was July the 31st. However, again, there are two more that are coming up. So if you're interested, just go to the Federal Register and register to attend one of those meetings. DC, in addition to several states, has received increased funding for programs to fight the opioid overdose epidemic. And so I won't go into all that detail, but there are several states across the country. I would be surprised if there isn't one state. But the federal government is putting money behind efforts that states are undergoing to curtail some of the opioid drug addiction, drug abuse, this epidemic. The thing about it, in D.C., Maryland, and Virginia, there's a special pool of money, $7.5 million, that's been divvied up, and it will also include heroin and illicitly manufactured fentanyl as well. So in addition to some of those other things that we're familiar with. And I think that might be it. Let's see if there's anything else more about opioid epidemic. Oh, this one, I gotta say this. So Alpha Bay, this is the largest criminal internet marketplace. It was called Alpha Bay, went into existence about 2 years ago. The Department of Justice finally caught up with these individuals that were manufacturing all kind of things. In addition to manufacturing things, they were distributing heroin, distributing fentanyl, but also things like firearms and toxic chemicals and computer hacking tools as well. So this was an internet marketplace called Alpha Bay, but the interesting thing about it, the guy who was behind it was 25 years old. So he started this when he was about 23, born in Canada, living in Thailand. And so this was a huge effort. It took the enforcement authorities from Thailand, the Netherlands, Lithuania, Canada, the UK, France, and the European Europol. They all have been working on this for a while to finally take down this 25-year-old who's raked in millions of dollars, but unfortunately caused a lot of harm with some of the things that he was doing. Unfortunately, when he was arrested, while arrested, he took his own life, which is unfortunate. But yeah, crazy stuff. And so he was the one behind this internet website that was able to distribute all these narcotics and firearms and all this stuff. It was called Alpha Bay. So I thought that was pretty interesting. All right, so I think that's enough of the news report. Sometimes I feel like the news later.
What about the weather?
So those are tidbits from our new NABP news you can use. Hopefully you can use. All right, on a more serious note. So let's see. Next item on our agenda are matters for consideration for the board. So that's pretty much all for our agenda for the open session. We need to do one quick thing. There were several people that came in and did not get an opportunity to introduce themselves. I'm going to start with one of our wonderful board colleagues who was able to join us. So for the record, Dr. Tamara McCants is here. She's a board member. And I saw maybe about three people who came in from the public. If you don't mind, please state your name and if you're affiliated with any organization.
Sure. I'm here with Sioux Sacred Pharmacy.
Welcome. Someone else.
I'm Kim Greenwood, registered nurse downstairs or upstairs on the third floor, adult immunization.
Yes. And the gentleman with the nice blue aqua shirt.
Suleimani Akubu from Howard University.
Okay. Are you a student?
Yes.
What year?
Fourth year.
P4 student. Wow. Okay. All right.
I'm Rashid Louie, and I'm a fourth year student as well from University of Maryland, Baltimore.
Okay, good. We got some variation in here. University, good. Is there anybody else who didn't get a chance to introduce? Tracy, yes.
Dr. Tracy Davis from American Healthcare Constitution.
Yes, welcome. So now we'll entertain comments from the public. Dr. Davis gave us a really good comment earlier about drug disposal and the need for us to take a look at, you know, informing consumers of how they can dispose of medication. We certainly don't want them to go into a store and be turned away from been able to dispose of their medications. And so again, I challenge you pharmacy students, come up with something. There's a need. You're pharmacy students. This is the pharmacy profession. Medication is involved. So let's put our brain cells together and come up with maybe something that we can try to do. Maybe we can partner up with some organizations or something like that to address the concern. Are there any other comments from the public at this time?
Just a quick comment. So I've been getting a couple of kind of inquiries from our pharmacists about the end of life bill that the DC, I guess, passed about assisted suicide and like the medication, how that's on law. Have we sent anything out from the Department of Board of Pharmacy regarding that? Because I think there's a process, a form that needs to be filled out by the pharmacist, sent back to the physician. There's a whole process in place for that. And supposedly some pharmacists got email with that information, but I know I'm registered, I didn't get the email.
What I understand, I believe a fax had went out to all the pharmacies,
okay.
But we can confirm that with Dr. Shauna White. But I did get a phone call about receiving a fax.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I didn't get anything, and I had some several pharmacies like, okay, how do I handle this? What do I need to do? Because I think the form has to be filled out within 48 hours or something. After that, and the prescriber can't transmit the prescription through fax. It either had to be handed by the physician to the pharmacy. There's different processes in place that has to be followed.
There is information on our own Department of Health website,
okay.
Death with Dignity, and
right.
there's a portal for you to use, so that information is there.
And that's a great newsletter article. I didn't even think about that. That is an excellent piece of information to put in our newsletter because it affects pharmacists.
Sure.
I didn't think about that. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Because I've been getting a lot of questions, and I'll be honest with you, I wasn't even aware of it because I didn't get any emails or anything, so
right.
I wasn't even sure.
Mm-hmm. We should also recognize in the newsletter that there are questions about how long that bill will be around. There are members of Congress who are trying to undo it. You know, I forget what state's in charge of the District of Columbia now. It used to be Utah. I don't know who's in charge of us now.
Okay.
But whoever they are, they were suggesting they were going to put forward legislation to undo that.
Okay. That's good to know. So we definitely would. I mean, I was watching it, you know, tidbits of it on the news, but really not even connected it to the pharmacist.
Oh, yeah.
All right, thanks. Good information. Yes.
Yeah, hi. I have a question, and this may apply to, I guess, either the Board of Pharmacy or maybe the Pharmaceutical Control Division, but with the new CDC guidelines and recommendations on opioids and the morphine milligram equivalents, they're looking at 50 as being the number that they're starting to surveil, I don't know if that's the correct word, but and then exceeding 90 milligrams, morphine milligram equivalents. Is there anything that, from a standpoint of pharmacy, and that comes out of the board, that, you know, that folks are looking at that as they're dispensing and documenting, and how do pharmacists document that they are, you know, aware of that, that, you know, we're applying the CDC guidelines? And I don't know if within the pharmacy information systems if there's even good ways of doing that.
Can someone from the community pharmacy environment kind of speak to that a little bit? Is there any way that it's in the system where when a prescription is being filled, you can kind of track the milligram equivalent?
I mean, you get a high dose alert depending upon the patient, right? And the pharmacist is supposed to use the professional judgment to evaluate that prescription and obviously call the prescriber if needed, and then they usually put an override if it's a high dose. But again, we get pharmacists in general get so many of those alerts and overrides, right? So, I mean, it's left up to judgment of the pharmacist, professional judgment.
Okay, that's interesting. Yes.
So morphine equivalent makes it a little bit difficult if it's a patient's filling more than one pharmacy, right? Because we can't really calculate the morphine equivalent unless we know everything the patient is on. That is where actually the PDMP comes in very good use. And so we are encouraging our pharmacists to start putting that in. So when they check the PDMP, they're making a notation of cash paying amount plus everything else and calculating that morphine equivalent dose to kind of know what's going on, because that's a better form of communication to the provider when you actually call them about certain situations that you see in the PDMP, that you're now using a more statistical measure like morphine equivalent dose. Also, I do know that some PBMs are now starting to look at how do they put in a block on, not really a block, because we don't really want to, you know, jeopardize the patient if they're addicted to medications. We want to help them get off the addiction of these medications. But I know some PBMs are now starting to put alerts that go in around high dose, or here's the morphine equivalent that we're seeing based on how many prescriptions have been filled so far. It's not in place yet. It's in some states, but not here in the D.C. area yet, but I know it's coming real soon.
Okay. I can comment on that. For Express Scripts, and we do. We actually have programs that we offer our clients, and actually our clients that are health plans and companies actually say, hey, I want to limit my folks, I don't care what the usage is, to a 30-day supply of an opiate, and then we'll allow overrides in certain situations. Mm-hmm. So that's very true. A lot of health plans are proactively taking that step to say, you know what, we've looked at the morphine equivalent, we've looked at the quantity limits, we want to put a quantity limit, just say we're not going to pay over a certain amount.
The problem is the cash pay.
That's
where the PDMP comes in very good use. And it's one thing that I guess is a good statement for me to kind of urge right now, that in D.C. we don't make it mandatory that our providers get in the PDMP. I think we should, as a city, make that a mandate that our providers have to log into the PDMP portal, because right now it's elective if they even want to get into it or even question it. And I think as we should look at our bordering states like Maryland and Virginia, where they make it mandatory, and we should start doing the same thing to really make them a little bit more aware of cash paying plus the ones that they're getting adjudicated to the insurance companies. The cash paying is falling through the loop there.
Gotcha. And real quick, Dr. Davis, you know, even if in Maryland, if you're a pharmacist, it's required that you register for PDM, whether you plan on ever using it or not, but to get your license renewed in Maryland, you have to register in their PDM, which is interesting.
I just wanted to say that AmeriHealth, we're one of the Medicaid plans here in D.C., and I'm actually meeting with D.C. Healthcare Finance before the end of this month to set up our opioid reduction program. So I think we are the first Medicaid program to go forward with it, but our program will be in three different stages. There'll be an October 1st state, a November 1st change, and then the last change will be January 1st for the reduction. So we'll start at 150 MME, and then I think it goes to 120 and down to 90. And then we're also looking at a 5-day supply for, and we have a certain group of people that we completely excluded, like cancer patients. They're not involved in this reduction program. So it is in progress.
Question for you. Is anybody aware of an article or where someone has sat down and kind of looked at opioid reduction programs? Which programs seem to be the most beneficial or what the differences are? Are there various different opioid reduction programs that are out there? Anybody's aware?
I think it's a tough issue as well because everybody and their mother is working on it. I actually do federal work as well, and everybody and their mother is looking at opiates right now. So you've got, and there's too many different stakeholders. You've got the physicians, everybody's trying to clamp down the physician, look in the PDMP and only write for this amount. And, you know, and then states are getting involved. Some states are actually saying, hey, we're going to tell you that you can only get 7 days at a time. We don't care who you are or what you're doing. There's the pharmacist, obviously, and then the patient. The Surgeon General himself even said, this is about 6 months ago, that, you know, most patients still don't understand that opiates are addictive.
Right.
So there's an educational component. So unfortunately, you know, back to your research questions, like everybody, you know, President's Task Force is looking at this. And I think overall, at least our stance is that you have to do a multifaceted approach.
Yeah.
You just cut off one chain, there's somebody else that needs to be controlled, if you will. Like,
I mean, who would have ever thought someone would manufacture fentanyl on their own and then cut fentanyl with elephant tranquil? Who
right.
Who would have thought that?
And a lot of the fake fentanyl is actually coming from, I just went to, the, I represent Maryland as well, and the Maryland Board of Pharmacy said their number one problem right now is fake fentanyl coming mm-hmm. in from China.
Just as a practical note, in response to the CDC opioid prescribing guidelines, when that happened, Kaiser changed the job description for the technician that they're required to calculate the MME when they receive the prescription. Just as a small tidbit for a pharmacist, just as another check for the multifaceted mm-hmm. approach. So that might be something else they can record on their record before it's automated across the system.
Calculating the morphine by the equivalent.
I know that usually when we talk about opioid overdose or just abuse or even substance abuse, as pharmacists, we tend to be, you know, calculating and, okay, well, how much should I dispense and what I shouldn't dispense. But I really think that we really, especially community pharmacists, are those of us that really interact with the community. Like, we really need to get comfortable about asking about substance abuse. Why would somebody, what must they be feeling if they want to use elephant tranquilizer? What are you trying to numb? And I know that might be a broader conversation, but I do think as pharmacists and clinicians, we need to take a little bit deeper look to try to figure out why are people wanting to self-medicate in this way. So if you know that someone is coming into your pharmacy and they have prescriptions that, you know, that they shouldn't be filled or they're trying to pay cash for it, I want to challenge us to think a little bit deeper and say, okay, instead of being like, no, I don't have it, or I'm going to confiscate this prescription and call the police, try to really figure out what is the issue? Why do you need more? Who's taking it? Are you taking it? Why? How long has this been going on? Just trying to go a little bit deeper to try to help the patient combat the substance abuse, because that's the bigger problem.
Alright, good discussion. What's my
name? Good morning, everyone.
Can you say your name? State your name for
yes.
the record.
My name is Andrew Gentles. I'm a pharmacist, also called field service officer, and I've had the opportunity to practice in different states, and so now I'm here in D.C., and I had a question for the board this morning, and really that was, the question I had was, I know back in December of 2016, the Board of Pharmacy, and I'm sure in collaboration with the Board of Medicine, you guys did a really good thing, and that was what went into law was a collaborative practice agreement. I see that. But looking at the statutes, it went into law in 2016, and I want to say good job. The follow-up question then is, where are we right now post the law? I think, you know, working in the community setting has been a big push from providers, because it really expands the scope of practice the pharmacist can provide, and it also helps with the types of services we can provide and the patient population that need pharmacists at large to deliver these services. And I wanted to see where we were post the law and where do we need to go. I just wanted to open up to the board to see where this stands.
Okay. I'll let Carla speak to that again. If you could just update, just to, I guess, let him know where we are with the rulemaking going back due to the public comments. Yeah.
So I gave that information earlier. It's going through the review process. Right now it's with the Attorney General's office undergoing legal submissions review.
So going through the review process, what exactly does that entail? That's probably the question I think I wanted to find out more. Going through the review process, what's the timeline? What should we expect? And the reason I'm asking, I'm not trying to be pushy, is that I think it's clear that it's been some time. You know, looking at the history and the minutes, it's been almost 3 years, I believe, 3-4 years. And when we look at the states, it's approximately 49 states across the country, I think, that have moved on this and have some kind of ruling in place. And I think for us, it's almost like an injustice to not have something that we can say, hey, listen, we have not formally finalized this. And maybe that's just me being an advocate and also saying, where are we with this? Where can this move along? What's the transparency?
So yeah, that is the information I gave earlier. So what I will explain is that the process when we do rulemaking, this was something that had to be done jointly between the Board of Pharmacy and the Board of Medicine. So that took quite a bit of time to get both boards on the same page. Once we published that rulemaking, we received a lot of comments. So then we went through those comments, and the Board of Pharmacy actually took the lead. And Mr. Freeman's not here today, but he worked very diligently to put together charts for us and help us to get through that huge number of comments. After we went through all those comments, we had to take them to the Board of Medicine, and then once both boards agreed to the changes, we are now going through the review process. The review process is that it goes through the Director of the Department of Health, the Deputy Mayor's Office, the Mayor's Office, the Attorney General's Office for Legal Sufficiency. Then it goes back to the Mayor's Office and the Deputy Mayor's Office, and then we publish it in the Register after the Office of Documents and Administrative Issuances approves it. If we make any changes other than typographic type changes or numbering changes, then it's considered substantive and we must do the entire thing again. So yes, this has been going on a very long period of time, but the boards have been actually working very hard through that entire time period to make this happen. Again, we held a public hearing at one point to get comments when we had people asking about institutional use, and we didn't have the expertise on the board, so we actually had a hearing so that we could get that information. We've had two boards working very hard over the past 3 years to try to get this moving forward. And they've given a lot of consideration to the comments that came out, and that's why we're going through this process again. I cannot give you a timeline because it sits in different people's offices until they are able to move it forward. And if they want changes, then we have to address those. So we are moving as expeditiously as we can, considering the bureaucratic process we have to go through.
And what can we as consumers do then, or pharmacists do in the meantime? Being that this went into law, would it be possible to say that if someone's practicing in a community setting right now, being that this is in law, they can implement a collaborative practice agreement in D.C.?
No, not until regulations are in place. And in fairness to this board tried to get collaborative practice agreements back in about 2005-ish. And at that time, it was not something that we were able to move forward, although we did try. So it's the board recognizes the importance of this. The board's been trying for a very long time to get this in place, and we are moving as fast as we can. But no one can do this until the regulations are in place.
Thank you.
Yeah, understanding the whole process. You remember the Saturday commercial that would come on, like how a bill becomes a law? Mm-hmm. You know, that whole process. Sometimes when I look at how how things go through the approval process in D.C., it kind of reminds me of that Saturday cartoon that used to come out. It's a lengthy process. And then to Carla's point, after that public comment period, there were a lot of comments. And then it's almost like, I don't want to say starting all over, but then you really did have to kind of go back and kind of put things back through the process. So we certainly recognize the importance of collaborative practice agreements. I especially recognize that importance for quite some time, since what, 1999, I guess. In terms of my practice area, and we really look forward to it to going through and finally getting all the way through the process so that we can have things properly in place.
And I've given you the edited version. There's a whole lot of behind the scenes back and forth and technical and change this and do this and why'd you do that kind of stuff that you don't have to be involved in. But
it's coming.
We have to do all that.
Yeah,
it's very time consuming and we're moving it as fast as we can.
But you know what? I'll tell you what we can do as pharmacists. As pharmacists, as nurses, as students, we can continue to support and push provider status. Because when you have a collaborative agreement and you have provider status going hand in hand, now you're really able to do some of the things that need to be done to address some of these needs. So for now, while we go through this process with getting it through the pipes, let's really rally around and continue to support and push provider status for pharmacists so that, you know, we are able to really engage under a collaborative practice agreement. At least that's something that we can do for now. And if you're curious of how we can do that, partner up with one of the pharmacy associations. We have a wonderful Washington, D.C. Pharmacist Association. We have APHA down the street, probably our biggest advocate in terms of provider status. ASHP up in Bethesda. So let's rally around our partners to really try to make sure we get that provider status. Any other comments?
Along those lines with provider status, but I do think that we are making some progress. If anybody is familiar with the MyHealth GPS program that DC Healthcare and Finance just came out or implemented July 1st.
What is it?
MyHealth GPS. And so, in my limited research, the DC Healthcare Finance basically is providing an incentive for clinics, providers to manage high utilizers. But it's the first document in where I've seen they actually list the clinical pharmacist as a part of the team in a fee for service or monetary compensation for managing a patient. So all of this is coming around at the same time. So if it's true that, the fact that collaborative, like we really need the collaborative practice stuff to really get on board so that we can legally work with entities, providers to really manage patients, especially when it's money being involved. So if we have to, I don't know who else we can advocate to. Everybody, we already know where the Board of Pharmacy, stands on this whole process. But there's actually, it's right now for pharmacists to really show our role in terms of managing these high utilizing patients and collaborating with the physicians and the providers with that. So it's the first time that DC even really listed the clinical pharmacists. And so when opportunities like that come forth, we have to take advantage of it, because if we continue to be silent and just say, oh, clinical pharmacists and don't do anything about it, then there's no incentive for DC Medicaid to pay pharmacists to do clinical services. When we have like the worst health disparities in the country still, even though most of our district residents have health insurance, we have the lowest amount of people that don't have health insurance, but we still have the highest health disparities. And the pharmacist is the missing link as far as I'm concerned.
Okay. Good comments. Very good comments. Other matters. No other comments?
Oh, I want to make an announcement if I could.
Yes.
So Washington, D.C. Pharmacists Association is not going to have a CE program as their annual meeting this year. But we are hosting an awards banquet. So if you know pharmacists out there that you want to recognize that have done wonderful things out in the community, we encourage you to get those submissions in. Starting now until August 10th, you can get those submissions in for DC pharmacists doing wonderful things out there. There's maybe about 6 to 8 different awards. We are hosting the awards banquet on October 7th. It's in the evening from 5 to 8, and it's open to the public. We are inviting people to come back to talk about pioneers in pharmacy and people who have done a lot of different things in the past that we consider pioneers in D.C. to come talk and motivate and encourage us to do more and to show us what has been done in the past and what is being done today. So it is free. It's open to the public. We want more to see what pharmacists are doing out there, so we're trying to get more people to be involved So if you know great pharmacists out there, get your submissions in. You can do it through the Washington, D.C. pharmacist link. I don't have that, or you can... I think there is a website or an email box that you can get that, and I will get that, but maybe you can put in the newsletter
yes.
too,
mm-hmm.
So that we can get that out there for nominations.
Thank you. I appreciate
mm-hmm.
that. Thank you. Let's see, this is August. We probably won't have a full meeting before our District 1 and 2 meeting. Just so that you know, our District 1 and 2 meeting is in September. It's at the Mystic in, where is it, Connecticut?
Yeah.
Yeah, up in Connecticut. And so we will make sure that the District of Columbia, of course, is represented, and we look forward to bringing back information that we get out of that meeting. So District 1 and 2, these are states, Maryland, D.C., Virginia, New York, Connecticut. I think now we have two territories in Canada that are now part of our district as well. So there are a whole list of states that will be gathering, and it's a joint meeting between NABP and AACP. So the deans from the pharmacy schools that are in the district as well will be there. So we'll bring back information and share what we get out of that. So that's coming in September. So just wanted to share that too. Anything else? If not, we will entertain a motion to adjourn our open session. So one of our wonderful board members.
Okay. Take a deep breath. Get a lot of oxygen in there, ready for this.
Madam Chair, I move that the board close the open public session portion of the meeting and move into the closed executive session portion of the meeting pursuant to DC Official Code 2-575B for the following purposes: to discuss disciplinary matters pursuant to 2-575B9, to seek the advice of counsel to the board to preserve the attorney-client privilege, or to approve settlement agreements pursuant to 2-575B4.
Thank you. That was a mouthful. So now we will entertain a roll call vote on the motion. Is there a second? Do we have a second?
I'll second.
All right, so we do have a second. Is there any discussion? Is there general consensus in favor of the motion?
Yes.
All right, now we'll do a roll call vote. So we will start off with
James Appleby. I vote in favor of the motion.
Tamara McCants, I vote in favor of the motion.
Eddie Curry, I vote in favor of the motion.
Benjamin Miles, I vote in favor of the motion.
All right, thank you. And so the motion is approved. So this concludes the public open session of the meeting. The board will now move into the closed executive session portion of the meeting pursuant to DC Official Code 2-575B for the reasons set forth in the motion. Thank you all for joining us. We will see you again in October for our next open session. And that's National Pharmacist Month. And we're looking forward to some great projects about how pharmacies are changing the world outside of just being tied to the product. So find a good way to celebrate National Pharmacist Month, even if it means taking lunch to your community pharmacist and saying job well done or something. So we'll see you all in October.